Thank you very much, Carl, and thank you very much, Dr. Walsh, for endowing this lecture that I'm going to have the pleasure of giving here. So I want first to put a nail in the coffin about this laterite myth of salts of the tropics turning to laterites. There is a great diversity of tropical soils. There are about more than 1,500 salt taxonomy subgroups. And thanks to David Limbaugh, I now know that there are 2,241 of them in the U.S. So there's a variety, and you have all the orders there. And that's one of the things that we have to realize. There's no such a thing as a tropical soil per se. I call them soils of the tropics. But that's one thing I wanted to emphasize. All this soil taxonomy can be simplified to something more practical to soil fertility people by using a functional classification system that Stan Buell and I and other ones concocted way back. And we call these things modifiers. And what you see, for example, here, comparing the three tropical regions of Africa, Latin America, and Asia, that's something like aluminum toxicity is much more prevalent in tropical America and less so in Africa. High phosphorus fixation, similar, nutrient reserves, similar. And there, in other words, we can translate, the point of this slide is that it's possible to translate soil taxonomy terminology into things such as high phosphorus fixation, aluminum toxicity, high erosion risk. There's nothing special about soil fertility in the tropics in terms of the processes. The processes are exactly the same, but their application and their relative importance can be very different in the tropics because of many, many conditions. For example, in the tropics, we have situations of too much nitrogen and too little nitrogen. We have them both. And the chart here by Peter Vitusek and a group shows tremendous differences. North China, certainly not in the tropics, tremendous excess of nitrogen. That's going down, thank goodness. The Midwest U.S., pretty much in equilibrium, which is very nice. And Western Kenya in gross disequilibrium. So we have to deal both with the problems of too much nitrogen and all the pollution and all the issues that are related to that in terms of leaching and gas emissions, and too little nitrogen on the other side. The history of soil fertility in the tropics can be shown in terms of paradigms. And the first paradigm is overcome soil constraints through the application of fertilizers, soil amendments, and irrigation to meet crop requirements. And this is sort of the classic agronomic paradigm that I was raised with as a graduate student. The second paradigm is kind of very different, rely more on biological processes to optimize nutrient cycling, minimizing external inputs, and maximizing the efficiency of the use of those external inputs, such as fertilizers. That started in the 1980s. And the third paradigm now is a bit broader than that, include both mineral and organic fertilizers, and improve crop germplasm, combined with the knowledge on how to adapt these practices to local conditions. And I added to the paradigm there, and addressing in relation to ecosystem services. Anyway, those are the paradigms. Cheryl Palm and co-workers, about 10 years ago, made a provocative statement that the natural capital of soils that underlies ecosystem services is primarily determined by three core properties: texture, mineralogy, and soil organic matter. And this is not specific to the tropics, this is soil science. Gary Esposito got very excited about that, and in a recent publication he said, yeah, you're talking about the genetics of soils in terms of what they inherited from the process of soil formation, texture, mineralogy, and the diet or the food, soil organic matter. So I want to try to put things together in terms of the core soil properties. If we deal with sandy soils, defined like in subtaxonomy families, less than 15% clay, those soils have high water infiltration, low water holding capacity, low soil organic carbon, unless they're waterlogged. They cannot sequester much carbon, and this is unfortunate, but very true. They have low cation exchange capacity and anion exchange capacity. They essentially have no phosphorus fixation, and generally they are of low soil fertility. Now we add mineralogy to that, and basically two types of clay minerals, those that are variable charge minerals and those that are permanent charge minerals. In Africa, on a four-wheel drive, you can tell the difference between the two. You don't need an X-ray diffraction to do that. But the point is, the variable charge soils occupy 60% of the tropics. The permanent charge soils about 10%, and a mixture someplace in between. So that also gets into the issue of soil variability. Not all soils of the tropics are a variable charge. We have them both, and even a mixture of two. And mineralogy then determines the inherent soil fertility through two things. One is the weatherable minerals in the sand and silt fractions, and the second is cation and anion exchange capacity of the clay minerals. So, now let's put them together on the clay soils. There, to me, in my view, there are two types of clay soils. Those clay soils with permanent charge and those clay soils with variable charge. Yeah, more than 35% clay. So the ones with permanent charge have medium water infiltration, high water holding capacity, high soil organic carbon, high cation exchange capacity, no anion exchange capacity. They do sequester carbon rather nicely. They have low phosphorus fixation. They're usually not aluminum toxic and generally of high fertility. These are all generalizations, of course. They're exceptions. But now the clay soils with variable charge have high water infiltration, but medium water holding capacity. They don't have that high. They have high soil organic carbon, low cation exchange capacity, but they have anion exchange capacity in the subsoil. They sequester carbon better, and by better means longer time than the clay soils with permanent charge. They have high phosphorus fixation. They're acid, very often aluminum toxic. Generally low fertility, but they can be highly productive with management. Originally of low fertility. The loamy soils, more than 15 and less than 35% clay, are somewhere in between. So that's kind of a rough conceptual picture. It's interesting to know that we look here at two very different soils, an oxisol and a mollisol. And they have similar soil organic carbon contents, even though you would imagine that the darker soil has more organic matter. No, they have it about the same. And actually, similar soybean yields. Considering soybean production in Brazil and considering soybean production in Midwestern United States. So the myth that these red ones are useless and so on, it's been totally disproved, and each one has advantages and limitations. Very important thing is the concept of anion exchange capacity, which we don't talk a lot here, but in this deep variable charge clays, subsoil acts very interesting matter. here's a maize crop or a series of maize crops, and at the start they do have a little bulge. This I'm talking about the green curve, and then 16 months later the yellowish curve, pretty much the same bulge. But when you get something deep rooted in it, like Sesbania legume fallow, at the beginning, again the green line, the profile at the beginning, is pretty much the same as with corn. But later, yeah. Oh, okay.
You can use that.
All right, let me try that. I don't get it. Anyway, later okay. it gets flat. Later it gets flat. So so something that had a bulge before of nitrates, now it doesn't have it. This is what I need to do with my own nitrate bulge here. this, by the way, let me talk about this a little more. We do have, of course, soils with variable charge in southeastern United States. And Bob Howarth, an ecologist friend of mine, was looking at nitrate loads in rivers in southeastern United States and couldn't find much. And I said, well, so this is why. So I think these are important things, the capacity to hold this anions. It's important here as well. Aluminum toxicity. We just went through a very nice session in honor of the late Gene Kamprad. And indeed, I think Gene Kamprad put our current paradigms on how to handle soil acidity in variable charge soils correctly. You lime to pH 5.5. But there's more than liming now that we have learned, primarily in Brazil. The ability to select cultivars of important crops that are tolerant to both high aluminum saturation and low phosphorus availability. They go together. Interestingly enough, the genes and so on, they go together. And Embrapa has developed maize hybrids yielding 6 to 8 metric tons per hectare, are tolerant to about 45% aluminum saturation, and also those cultivars need only 5 ppm of salt test malic 1P instead of 10, like the previous ones. So they're much more efficient at using low phosphorus. So this is the advantage of being able to get, for the breeders working together with the soil scientists, to get manage soil acidity using germplasm is a very notable point. And there's another major component to this, gypsum. Why do we want to add gypsum to acid tropical soils? Can we do that to sodic soils? And the reason to that is that gypsum moves quickly down and allows root development way down when the levels of calcium are so low that roots cannot grow. And roots need calcium where they are in their tips. They need calcium in the very, very subsoil. So on the left-hand side, you have the root profile of one of these oxazoles and so on with lime and phosphorus, but no gypsum. And most of the roots are concentrated up here. With the gypsum, the roots are concentrated, they are dispersed better. And in this case, this one yielded 6 tons per hectare, and this one yielded nothing. And coming back to the anion exchange capacity, the one with gypsum has taken the bulge off, again, that I should do. And the one without gypsum shows a nitrate bulge sitting over there, which is a nice safety net, but we rather is taken up by the plants. So that's a third element that is very important looking at the subsoil. So now we get into a situation of this sort of root development. And I hope you can see this here. But this guy is not particularly tall, but I think we're talking about 1.5 meters of soil here. And this is grazed pasture with Brachiaria pasture, Brachiaria species that is very aluminum tolerant. And they've added gypsum too. So what you have is a large concentration of roots in the subsoil. And of course, when there are droughts, the roots are there and to help you out instead of depending only on the topsoil. So I think one of the things that we have learned in the tropics is the ability to utilize the whole soil volume. And how deep it goes, we don't know. But in this case here, I would say it's as deep as this, where the roots were concentrated. We're looking at the whole thing, not just at the topsoil in terms of soil fertility. Now, some other issues are old, but very, very important for any fertilizer rate recommendation based on yield response. Instead of using the quadratic or any of Mitscherlich or other equations, the use of linear response and plateau has really saved us a lot of fertilizer. Because the idea is we don't want to get into what's the minimum, the maximum bang for the last amount of fertilizer. That in this particular case, which is potatoes in Peru, it was about 180 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. We want to get where the curves get flat, and in that case, what you needed was less than half, 75 versus 160. So let's not go for maximum yields. 80% of maximum yields big is good enough. And of course, this part of the curve is very variable. So just doing that, we save a lot of fertilizer and then increase tremendously the efficiency of fertilizer use. The Birch effect, which was discussed yesterday by Ray Weil, it's now really accepted in the international community. Well, that didn't happen when Harry Birch discovered it in 1958 in Kenya. The Birch effect is a flush of nitrogen mineralization upon a long dry period when the soil is suddenly wetted by the first rains. And it just gives you a peak. And then it goes down. And then in this case, there's a short rainy season, and it did the same thing. That means that if you have plants here that are there at that time, like some permanent crops, like pastures, you can take advantage of a huge amount of nitrogen taken up. It's harder to do with crops that you plant, but we should remember this thing, and I'm getting a feeling, and I'm not going to show you any data on that, but I'm getting a feeling that we're putting too much weight in the tropics. With this situation, we're putting too much nitrogen at planting, as opposed to at whatever is the right reproductive rate of the crop. I think there's data from Pam Mattson from Stanford, working in northern Mexico, that shows that putting more later when the soil when the crop is knee high or maximum tillering for rice or whatever. It may not increase your yield, but it sure increases fertilizer nitrogen recovery and decreases gas emissions to the atmosphere. So I think we've got to start rethinking, at least in this under these conditions, and having the Birch effect that to have to consider later nitrogen applications. One thing that's happened in when scientists are trying to introduce a biological inoculation, not with our soybeans, because that happens right with the seed treatments, but other ones that are more difficult to do, such as mycorrhiza inoculation. And usually the literature tells you, including a lot of the tropical literature, tells you that if you add any phosphorus, you kill the mycorrhiza. The mycorrhiza will not develop, the plant doesn't need phosphorus anymore, and sort of is a yes, no, zero, one situation. What colleagues of ours have found in Cuba, Dr. Ramon Rivera, is instead of looking at the extremes, what he did, he had several rates of inoculum times several rates of phosphorus. And what he found was that mycorrhizal inoculation without phosphorus, it wasn't very good. This is taro arrowroot malanga, one of our basic food crops. It's a root crop. But if you put here on the right-hand side, the moderate inoculation rate, saving again inoculants, and moderate phosphorus rates, you get the maximum report yields. In other words, it tells us that when we're doing organic and inorganic, it doesn't pay to go to the extremes. I think the interaction in the middle is best. And this is, I think, the way to go. There's a lot of interest, of course, in new biological inoculation in the tropics, particularly in Cuba. Another thing is Brazil is just the most amazing country. But the average nitrogen fertilizer rate of all crops in Brazil is just 10 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per crop. This is below the average nitrogen rates in Africa. And Brazil has a thriving agriculture. And of course, the rest is given by biological nitrogen fixation. And especially in soybeans like this, it's just amazing. The very large use of biological nitrogen fixation. Now this one comes with a quirk. And the quirk is in sugarcane, some tropical pasture grasses that obviously are not fixing nitrogen by rhizobium. There is something going on. And the something's going on is that you can get 100 to 200 kilos of nitrogen per hectare accumulated by the harvest of sugarcane, the yearly harvest of sugarcane. And that cannot possibly come from soil reserves. And they don't use any nitrogen fertilizer. So the possibility of endophytic biological nitrogen fixation in grasses, I think it's real. And this is very contested. This is contested agronomy. But I think the evidence in Brazil now over several decades, this was started by Johanna de Bruyner, but now there are many. Something is happening because grasses like sugarcane or brachiaria are taking nitrogen that the soil cannot supply without any nitrogen fertilizer. So we may have this epiphytic inside plant nitrogen fixation. This is work in progress, but difference. Now let's go into phosphorus. Phosphorus is believed to be a non-renewable resource. And we're all worried about when are we going to run out of phosphorus. The catastrophic school of thought tells you, it's in the next few years. And the more optimistic people with a better data says, well, it's going to be in the order of hundreds of years, but not very many hundreds. So this is because, let me see if I can do what you were suggesting. This is because there is no closed phosphorus
cycle. Is that showing up on the screen?
I don't know.
Is that showing up?
Yeah, okay. Okay, well then, great. I can dispense with that. So, whoops, that's not what I wanted to show you. We have the cycle starting with the phosphate rocks, deposits, direct application, converted into fertilizers, whatever, including manures, and the soil and the and the plant biomass accumulating, and eventually things run down by runoff or erosion or sewage to the oceans and fresh water, marine plant biomass, and burial in the lithosphere of coastal sediments. But reading this literature, I found an extra thing. This is Wyclef's Mills to say that there is tectonic uplift. Tectonic uplift, in other words, a circle closes. There is tectonic uplift of this lost phosphorus from mainly coastal areas and so on, continental shelves where it accumulates, and it goes back. And the rate seems to be in the order of 111 to 185 teragrams of phosphate rock per year. And it just so happened that the amount of phosphorus, current phosphorus extraction right now, is right in the middle of that. So, at geological time scales, there's certainly a closed cycle. And if this is correct, and I'm putting it here as a hypothesis, we may expect to have a continuous increase of phosphate rock deposits, probably in the continental shelves, and there may or may not be of high value and so on, God knows, and accessibility. But I don't think we can really say that phosphorus is not a renewable resource. It also doesn't make sense. It has to go somewhere and doesn't go into the atmosphere. So this requires a lot of research, and putting it here as a hypothesis, not as a given. Then, looking at the isotherms of phosphorus fixation, the pioneering work of Fox and Campreth, who were discussing at the Campreth symposium this afternoon, it was pretty much indicated there that an amount of phosphorus sorbed to give a soil solution concentration of 0.2 ppm was considered the agronomically relevant estimate of phosphorus sorption. But looking at the literature, and I'll show you in a moment, I think this is exaggerated. The data I will show you in a moment indicates that a concentration much lower, instead of 0.2, 0.01, fits better to provide 80% of the maximum crop yields. I'm not going to show you that, but that is well related with the critical levels of soil tests. So in the bottom there, you see a soil solution of 0.2. It gives you, and you relate it to the soil test values, Bray, Malik, Olson. It gives you levels that are way out of line, way off of what we consider critical soil test levels. Now, in this data set, and there was nothing for 0.01, but there was something for 0.006 and 0.12. And this gives us critical levels that we're more used to in the ballpark, that we're more used to of the three main soil tests. So if we want to have a better understanding of the relationship between phosphorus sorption and phosphorus soil tests, I think we should go to a much lower level. Now, something else that's happening to the soil in terms of phosphorus that is just amazing. And this I found just by gathering data in preparation for the second edition of my book. Basically, and whether the data comes from an AlphaSol in Rothamsted with 105 years of research, or all other kinds of soils, except for the sandy ones, you're dealing with something like about 50% of the applied phosphorus as phosphorus fertilizer is still there in the topsoil, with the exception of the sandy soils, still there. And these are the data that we have from different places. And I think there's something happening here. Of course, we don't have the data from temperate UK of Rothamsted, 145 years old exhaustion trial. But we have some that go 10 years or so, that tells you the same. So I haven't had a chance to calculate how much that is, but it's got to be a lot. The trick is, how can we make it available? And we don't know how. We don't know how. It's certainly a very good thesis topic to do. And we have a colleague in China who is working with that, taking a microbiological approach to see if he can get something there to break that very, very stable phosphorus compounds, whatever they may be. But anyway, that's another one. Let's take a look. When I worked in North Carolina, there were some soils there that were testing over 100 ppm of phosphorus by the Melick method. Could almost mine those for phosphorus. How much phosphorus farmers have applied for centuries. So we got this, and I think we should take a look at it. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about Africa, and the point of sub-Saharan Africa, just comparing overall cereal yields. And if you do it in bushels per acre, the numbers get complicated. But if you do it in metric tons per hectare, very simple. Africa, 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, was averaging 1 metric ton per hectare of corn. For Latin America and South and East Asia, 3. China, 5. North America, Europe, and Japan, 10. And we know that here in the U.S., the yields are much more higher. In many places, higher than 160 bushels per acre, higher than 160 bushels per acre. But these are global FAO figures. So 1, 3, 5, 10. That's something we can remember. And I think the strategy now is to go from 1 to 3, which doesn't mean much by American or European standards, but it would triple maize production in Africa. Then go to 5, try to get to the Chinese level now. Then go to 10. The main soil fertility problem, and probably the main biological limiting factor in smallholder farming in Africa, is soil nutrient depletion. It's not that most of the soils We're fairly good. AlphaSols, some very good oxysols, inceptisols, and so on. Some of the soils were bad. Actually, very little acidity compared to soils of Latin America. What has been that they've been depleted of nutrients. Farmers have taken the nutrients out with a crop harvest without returning them as fertilizers or manures or something. And now we're seeing that it's very clear that there's a relationship between this low yields of corn that you see there, the 1 ton per hectare type, and stunting in children in the past year. These are 15, 16-year-old kids, and they look like they're 10. And that stunting also causes just some irretrievable damage early early in the womb and during the first 2 years of life of the children. So the economists are listening to this, and I'm so happy, because before I couldn't talk to agricultural economists that were giving me these regression equations for the perfect fertilizer response curve. That's not the point. But now the economists and Chris Barry and his colleagues from Cornell define the poverty trap as poor soils resulting in low yields and low household capital. Low household capital prevents investments in soil nutrients, which is a primary constraint on soil productivity. So it's not like the Green Revolution in Asia or later in Latin America, where the soils were not the main limiting factor, because they were using some very fertile soils, but it was a germplasm. In this case, it's to a very large extent the soil fertility depletion. So, very low levels of fertilizer use in Africa. It was about 8 kilos of NPK per hectare by the time there was this Africa Fertilizer Summit in Nigeria in 2006. And this was the first time that I've heard a large meeting in Africa talk about fertilizers and talk about soil fertility. Many of us soil scientists were saying, yay, you know, now they're listening to us for the first time. And indeed, the commitment was to increase from 8 to 50 kilograms of NPK per hectare, still a ridiculous amount. And some countries have done it. Malawi and Zambia, but not Mozambique. And nevertheless, the average cereal yields in sub-Saharan Africa have taken off at about 2005. And what used to be about 1 ton per hectare, now it's getting to 1.5, and that's as of 2014. We're waiting for the FAO data. Well, it's a 50% increase. The numbers are small, but it changed the shape of the curve. It's changed the shape of the curve. And what we hope is that in a few years, maybe in a decade, you get at 3 tons per hectare, and then that'll be a very different thing. Most African soils and climates can get you 10 tons per hectare of maize, 160 bushels to the acre. With good hybrids and good fertility, it's possible. So from the agronomic point of view, it's not that big a deal. It is a very big deal from the poverty point of view. So looking at fertilizer use again, with this metric on the y-axis of kilograms of NPK per hectare, and looking at the years, you see that the red, which is Malawi, and the blue, that is Zambia, is going up quite a bit. And and translating that into now maize yields, and use maize here because it's the most important crop, at least in half of Africa, food crop, not feed crop, food crop. And we could say the same things about other ones like cassava or sorghum or many other ones. But what you see here is that with fertilizer use, in this case, again, kilograms nitrogen per hectare, kilograms of NPK per hectare, the maize yields are going up. Some of these numbers here are very nice because they're approaching 3 tons per hectare, but it has to be the whole continent. So how about organic fertilizers? What's happening? A lot is happening with organic fertilizers. And in this case, it's an improved leguminous fallow growing after corn, growing after maize. The species called Tephrosia. And when you have the whole field covered with that during the dry season, grows beautifully during the dry season without any irrigation. It captures about 160 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. It recycles potassium, because the roots are deep, recycles micronutrients, and obviously adds carbon. But the adoption of this is essentially nil. And I spent about 10 years when I was director of ECRAF pushing for these things and doing research on these things, and had them, the results are fantastic from the experimental scientific point of view, published and so on, all sorts of different species and cultivars of species from the wettest to the driest areas, and everything's fine, and the farmers loved it as long as they were able to sell the seed to some NGO. The minute that stopped, 93% of them stopped. Because they were, and those that continued are in great shape. Because all the things that we in research found, increasing food production of the crop afterwards, and increasing fuel wood production, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all is true. But so in that pitiful 7% adoption, those are out of poverty. And the 93% of people who tried it and threw it away, it really made me feel very bad after I left ECRAF. And I was wandering around in the Millennium Village in Tanzania, just scratching my head, why? And it just hit me. Financials, money, fertilizers are subsidized now in most of Africa. And farmers love fertilizers. They've always had. But now that they can afford it through subsidies and then a little bit more with credit schemes, well, there's no subsidy. There's no financial incentive for these things. To provide a subsidy for the seed, that's nothing. So we have to work. We have to work on that in terms of policy issues, how you give them financial resources. Nevertheless, there's been a lot of scientific progress in classifying organic inputs in terms of their release. How quickly do they really mineralize nitrogen? And here you have Sherrill Palms and Chilingus decision trees. That basically says if you have more than 2.5% nitrogen, the answer is yes. And lingering continents less than 15%, you can incorporate directly with annual crops, or class one, if not, mix it with mineral fertilizers or other high quality organics, which would be manures. And if it's not, if you have less than 2.5% and more than 15%, I think this is backwards here, and more than 15%, sorry, you could mix it with mineral fertilizers or add to compost, and the ones that are both no and no, surface applied for erosion and control and water holding capacity, but not for any fertility thing. That is now, this has been proven throughout many, many plant materials. But how about the other kinds, the manures and composts? So I tried to put my head together with the literature on that. So there's class five. The first four are the inputs, the plant biomass inputs. High quality animal manures, and looking at the literature, they have to be higher than 1.25, not 2.5% nitrogen, have a certain CN ratio, and have low phosphorus contents. And those are the ones that you have here, and you can incorporate before planting, mix it with mineral fertilizer. You can do whatever you want with it. They're high quality manures. We do have a problem because of this fertility depletion of low quality manures in Africa. And yeah, you can classify them by nitrogen and CN ratio, but they actually do immobilize nitrogen rather than mineralize nitrogen from manure. manure can be an immobilizing agent, taking a few nitrate or ammonium ions out of the soils and sucking it up. Why? Because the cattle is fed on this very low fertility grasses, very poor nutrition, and then the manures are also of poor quality. Then classes 7 and 8 are the compost. Again, we want compost with low lignin and high nitrogen, just like the plants, well decomposed without contamination with inorganic materials or municipal waste that may carry heavy metals. And we've seen a lot of low quality composts, poorly decomposed, contaminated with trash, electric wires, and lots of heavy metal, and obviously you should not use. Okay, the point is that now, with a different kind of organic inputs, the fertilizers, they're fairly reliable measurements of what you should use. Before, it was all a black box, it was all organic inputs. Now there's some prediction there. There's a big problem in terms of soil testing, which is badly needed. And the problem is that if you send your soil tests like you do in this country to a central laboratory, first, it may never get there. Second, if it gets there, it may be thrown in a closet because the labs do not have the their still is broken, or there's no electricity, or there's no budget, or whatever. And if you get lucky to get a mail back with the recommendations, it's probably 20, 30 years old. So that's the problem. It's just that they simply don't work. Now, there are commercial laboratories that charge high prices, and the commercial plantations like tea and coffee and so on utilize it. But I'm talking about the smallholder farmer. So Ray Weil here. In the audience, take a there he is, invented a box, which now we call SoilDoc, which is a portable lab in the box, and it uses batteries, and it uses also bottled water available, which is available all over Africa, the kind of stuff we drink out of here. There, what you do is you measure the blank and subtract it. And an Android tablet that is programmed to change, do all the calculations from so many so many this and that you directly measured into kilograms per hectare and so on. And this has the capacity now to measure pH, electrical conductivity, nitrate, which is not all that useful, but there's a nitrate sensor, a phosphorus sensor, sulfur sensor, potassium sensor, and very importantly, what is now called active carbon, or biologically active carbon, which is one of these NRCS soil health approved measures that Ray had a lot to do with it. What's coming out of this is a series of maps. And this is a large scale map. You can see that there is 2 kilometers. The legend here is 2 kilometers. Different places in a specific place in Malawi. The colors tell you what they are, but I tried to summarize it. And what we find is that these fields, farmers' fields, are 100% deficient in nitrogen. nothing surprising there. 67% deficient in phosphorus, 55% deficient in active carbon, which means you need to add more manures or compost or leaf. You need to add some organic inputs there, basically to wake up the microbes, have something better. But you need to add that. 42% were below the critical level of potassium, and very importantly, in this case, only 29% were deficient in sulfur, but sulfur deficiencies are all over Africa, and they're quite acute, and I think this is partly because we're not using sulfur-bearing fertilizers anymore. And something similar has occurred here, and there's a recent book by the Soil Science Society of America on problems with sulfur. Anyway, the point is, now, at this level, with a great on-farm variability that there is in Africa, small farms with most of the soils closer to the house are quite fertile. The soils away are not, and difference and so on. Now we have to get to the point that with blending, using a lot of fertilizer blendings, to develop specific formula for specific areas. That is going on right now. There's quite a surge in blending plants in Africa. So we hope that this will give us we don't lose crops just because of sulfur deficiency or just because we need to give it a shot of organic inputs. So the highlights, to summarize, the highlights, I'm bringing them here, and some of them, by the way, also happen in the non-tropical regions, but mainly from the tropics. Anion exchange capacity in oxidic subsoils is a tremendous safety net to nitrates and sulfates. If soils of the Midwest would have the safety net, we would not have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, I would dare say. Unfortunately, they don't have a safety net because they don't have the variable charge soils. But so that has to be dealt other ways. We're learning how to utilize the full subsoil volume as deep as the roots go with gypsum, aluminum tolerant cultivars, and this means large carbon sequestration in the subsoil. And the numbers for carbon sequestration are high. I'm not presenting them here, but also in the subsoil where they're going to be more protected than in the topsoil. Practice using a linear response and plateau model and shoot for 80% maximum yields as far as fertilizer recommendation. This is an old story. Caden Nelson, 1971 paper, started this in 1971. Take advantage of the birch effect. Cannot ignore it. It's there in the areas where there's strong dry season. Let's find out about this endophytic biological nitrogen fixation in sugarcane and tropical grasses. This needs more work. Now, yeah, we have been able to classify organic inputs. Low quality cattle manures immobilized nitrogen. And we're learning that combining biological inoculation rates of biological inputs, such as mycorrhiza, with different rates of fertilizer rates is much better. A phosphorus is some sort of a renewable resource. I don't know whether this has any practical implications or not, but at least you should look at it. That we can use lower critical levels for phosphorus sorption, 0.1 milligrams per liter as opposed to 0.01 as opposed to 0.2, relates better with soil test. Half of the fertilizer applied remains in the topsoil, so how do we utilize that? Big research questions. Bringing soil test lab to the field is really important. We don't have the soil testing services we have in this country, where you already send your soil sample with a barcode, and it's FedEx to the lab, and you get the recommendation in your cell phone in a couple of days or so. Don't have that. Importance of testing for active carbon and for sulfur. And then use science to disprove common misconceptions. Stand up to science, and I'm going to give you a personal example of that last one. In 1972, many of us at North Carolina State University started a project in the Amazon of Peru, and the idea was that we were questioning the conventional knowledge that you cannot grow crops continuously in the Amazon. So the top photo there shows a much younger Pedro Sanchez in 1972, with and next to my buddy there, very good crop of soybeans, and we have the same thing for rice and for maize and other things. And then, boy, we were attacked. This a paper on this was published in the Soil Science Society of America Journal in 1983, and a little bit later, a simpler version on Science Magazine. And boy, did we ever get attacked by well-intentioned, but not very scientific environmentalists. I wouldn't say ecologists, environmentalists. And some of them were what I call the catastrophic school of thought. If you do this, you're going to destroy the Amazon, and you're going to destroy everything, and anyway, you cannot do it because it's impossible to grow crops in the Amazon, where the soils were the same. They're mostly ultra-soils, just like we have in southeastern United States, which is what led us to say we can do it in North Carolina. How about trying to do it here? It was a very nasty article in Bioscience in the early 80s by Philip Fernside, saying that rethinking continuous cultivation in Amazonia and the Yurimaguas technology may not provide bountiful harvest predicted by its originators. We never predicted bountiful harvest. But anyway, it was this sort of purple journalism. So it's there. But look what happened. It didn't happen in the Amazon of Peru at all. It happened in the Amazon of Brazil. And the photo below shows one of the hundred thousands of hectares of soybeans now growing in the Amazon of Brazil. And they're getting yields that are excellent. Of course, they took good care of many things, clearing the land appropriately, and now that is by slash and burn to provide ashes. And Embrapa developed the varieties and so on. So it's not only perfectly possible, but it's going at the scales of millions of hectares. And even better now, so this is what I say. Okay, we were attacked by this. And now, many years later, it's been totally proven that is correct at scale. But things are getting even better. This is in the state of Mato Grosso, only one state of Brazil, huge state. It covers about four or five Midwestern states in terms of size. But anyway, what you see here is the bars are yearly deforestation rates, and they were going more and more and more until something happened in 2005. The line going up, the black line going up, is soybean production. That has increased. And the dotted line on top is cattle production, or the herd of cattle in this case, that also has increased. So here you have a situation now, after 2005, that deforestation has gone down to very low levels. Here is jumping up again, but not that bad. Deforestation has gone down while soybean and cattle production has gone up. This is intensification, of course. In this area, there is a prohibition of cutting any primary forest. So you cut the secondary forest, or most of the times you use degraded pastures to start growing soybeans in rotation with corn or in rotation with other things. And this is the ideal. Nobody wants to continue deforesting the Amazon, but it's really going down now. Now, how long is this? I don't know how long will this start, because this is a very political thing. But the situation is there. So I'm putting this as my last point to the younger soil scientists in this audience. Don't be afraid. Stand up on your results. After all, if you got a peer review and it's published in the Soil Science Society of America Journal, it's going to be okay, no? So if you're sure about the results, stand up to them. And yeah, a lot of battles, a lot of people been accused of being a deforester of the Amazon and all sorts of things like that. But on contentious issues that we have right now, and soil science is now full of contentious issues, let us stand on our science. Thank you very much.